This is a Power 98.7 podcast. Now we're talking. Subscribe to Power 98.7 podcasts in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. There's more on power987.co.za.
The latest news and talk. Hot, fresh, and delivered when you want it. Power 98.7. Now we're talking.
It's 19:34 here on Power Business. It's also Wednesday. It means we move into our Power Boardroom. Tonight we are unpacking the ins and outs of the music business. And I think it's fitting right with 30 years into this democracy. And one thing I am certain about is the way that we consumed and thought of music as a business in 1994 is certainly slightly different, or maybe even more different here in 2024. We decided to have that conversation, but also looking at, the regulatory landscape there is. Does it support the way in which we move? And then also looking at the global landscape, because of course, with the introduction of streaming and social media, all of that has also really changed the way we consume music, and also might has even changed how much artists can make from their music. So joining us to have that conversation is Jonathan Shaw, music producer, a business consultant, and music technology and business lecturer at MND Multimedia Institute, and Nkateko Maluleke, who's a general manager of the music arena. Good evening to you both, and thank you so much for joining us tonight. Wonderful. Thank you for being with us. I think before we get into really the nitty, I'd like us to maybe reflect on the way that the music industry has changed in the last 30 years. I think we're at this wonderful milestone as a country. We might as well look at what it might have been in 1994 versus what we're faced with in 2024. Jonathan, we'll start with you.
Sure, great. Nalitando, so, I mean, I remember I grew up in the 90s, and I was very interested in music. And one thing I can say is that, back then, all the radio stations used to play rock music. And I think we have a vastly different cultural experience on media today. And also, the world is our global oyster. Back then, you're pretty much limited to whatever the mainstream media fed you as a music listener. And then in terms of the industry, I remember it was very difficult for musicians and local bands to get onto the radio. It seemed almost impossible. Yet we also had some of the biggest acts of the 80s, from South Africa in some ways. And in terms of doing business, there was very little information about how the industry ran. So in 94, we started our first policy development for the music industry. There was a growth strategy that was developed around that time, and that was focused on understanding what the music climate was and all the problems that musicians faced. And key to that was, I think, a lot of the business education behind the industry. And moving into the 2000s, I found myself as a very young man trying to make a living out of music and got into recording. And from there, it was painfully apparent about how little people knew about the business side of the industry. And the saying goes that musicians die as paupers, and hopefully we can make a difference with the way things have gone nowadays. So that's where I sort of remember the industry starting out from.
Wonderful. Nkateko, I'd like to bring you in here, your reflections from how things used to be back in the day.
Look, democracy, I think there's been a lot of ways to fought.
I'm sorry, I want to interrupt you a little bit. I would like to get you on a stronger line. We're missing a lot of what you're saying there. I'm going to send you back to Melissa to help us with that, just to possibly see, how we can make sure that we can hear you more clearly there. Okay. Yeah, let's do that. Jonathan, I think while we wait for that, and I'm keen to get some of Nkateko's reflections in a bit, but I'd also like us then to then speak about, the way in which, I mean, I also grew up in the 90s, I think. Yeah, I was born in 91, so I grew up in the 90s. And I remember, a CD. I remember my parents having, is it called the vinyl? The very big CD. But of course, it was this music that you could almost touch and put in your hands. And that's not quite the case anymore. What was that transformation like for, people who were in the sector? It did feel like it happened quickly and overnight. But of course, we know that it was quite a transition.
I remember growing up listening to cassette tapes, and the only way to get your favorite songs was to take them off the radio sometimes. And that was a big medium for me, I remember growing up. And so all your local bands and so on, you'd wait on for the radio to play it and you'd home tape it. And of course, that wasn't necessarily legal back then. But people would buy primarily on tapes. And I remember you had a whole 40 minutes that you could fit on a tape. Whereas nowadays, I mean, we've gone through vinyl, which I think was also around 40 minutes odd. And then CD introduced 70 minutes of listening time. And we moved to then now streaming and downloads before that, where it seems as though the young kids today have no idea what it was like to be limited or stuck with an album for a few months because you couldn't afford to buy a different one. And all of these things play a role in terms of music consumption today. You know, I think one of the biggest things is that the law hasn't caught up necessarily or the way that the business gets done. And a lot of young people getting into the business today still have the impression of a model that was developed in the 1980s when you had megastars selling more records than they could ever sell today. Even with all the billions of streams that are going on. And that said, back in the 80s, we had recording studios and record companies, and that was the only way that you could actually get your music recorded properly. And as time went along, I remember starting out recording on big desks and hard drives, eventually moving to the computer and these big desktop computers. And then finally to a laptop that I now use today that's you know, 10 times more powerful than what I had to record with back then. And I think in some ways the kids have it easy today. They can make a song pretty much on their phones if you're willing and wanting to find out how to do it. And so there's so many ways that one can access the industry today, whereas back then there was very much what we would say gatekeeped. There was a gatekeeper that you had to go through in order to get your music recorded in some ways. And so the market has opened up with all the physical goods that we would go and buy. I mean, do you remember walking through Look and Listen and mm-hmm. Musica and Reliable and all of these, big warehouses that you could just get awed about the amount of music that was out there physically? It was a physical experience, I think. And nowadays, a lot of that has gone away in the sense that I put on my streaming service and I'm like, well, what should I listen to today? Because I have no idea. So it's changed so much.
Wonderful, Katego. I do believe that you're on a stronger line. I really want to get your thoughts. We were reflecting on 1994 versus 2024 where the business of music is concerned.
Yes. So I think where I got cut off was actually strictly on the evolution of the music industry. But also when we link it to the 30 years of democracy, if you think about it, a lot of movements were centered around music. So music played a significant role in getting us to where we are today. Yeah. The business side of it has really evolved. I mean, I just caught a bit end of what John was saying, that if you look at how music is consumed and also sold and how it is now, it's completely different. The landscape has really shifted. But it does not still take away the fact that music is a unifier. Music is universal. You look at how we gather as people. The element of gatherings in the background is music, whether it's actively or just in the background is something that you switch on. And in between, you tap into it. Look at the culture of Sunday music, where we don't even know what to do on a Sunday without music in the background, whether you're cooking or just sitting with friends and family. So music is a very essential part of our economy. There's also the business aspect that is always troubled and it's always in the news, most often for the wrong reasons. So I'm hoping we'll be able to touch onto that as well as the conversation unfolds.
Yes, I want to speak about that because something Jonathan also touched on here is the issue of legislation, the regulatory environment, not quite catching up to the times. Of course, so we live in a world where music is way more accessible than it has been, but also the barriers to entry have been lowered for new artists. Also, nobody buys a CD or a disc or anything of the likes anymore. But all of this means that there's been a change in how money is made and maybe even in how money is spent in the industry. I'm keen to get your reflections on that one too.
You know, my reflection is that if we look at regulatory, it's one. But I think it's more contractual. That's where it becomes more complicated, because the copyright provision is simple. It's exactly that. But how you now apply the rights practically and commercially is a different story. And that's where the most challenges come from. So when you look at an older musician versus the musician now, the landscape has also shifted. The younger ones want to know, they ask more questions. The older one, we're just happy to get into studio, produce amazing music, and sell, without necessarily worrying about the contractual undertakings that they've made to the record label. At the end, we end up having with musicians who die as paupers, who realize only at the end that they don't own any of their works or their musical works. So it's a very... The evolution came with its own challenges, but it also fixed some of the challenges that I think we've had over the years in the music industry.
Well, that said, I also want to speak about how streaming is. Because, of course, with streaming, I think all people on their phone have one or two services that they subscribe to. And I think I pay $60 a month. I'm not quite sure how if that's really the value for all the music that I consume. I'm pretty sure that that's not quite the case. How does this model work? And also, does it really support artists in the way that it should, Jonathan?
So... you know, streaming was a great hope at one point in time, that it would allow greater access to a lot more music. It would allow a lot more musicians to have access to an audience. And of course, there was this idea that there would be a more direct, relationship with your audience if you were able to stream and so on. And I mean, I think a lot of the criticisms are aimed now at, and in some ways, rightly so, at the fact that it's not really paying back much to the musicians at all. Mm-hmm. There's the idea of one stream pretty much making you less than 1 cent in terms of earnings, and you can't sustain yourself unless you are a major star of some sort. And only then will you actually see some sort of return from streaming. And so people are getting very frustrated with the model as a business model, that it's not really supporting businesses so much anymore. And I say that because what happened was there was a big streaming boom. But what Spotify has revealed, for example, is that a lot of those streams are starting to be generated by robots and streaming farms, and these sort of problems where 100 phones will get hooked up and all stream the same account in order to generate a false number of views and so on, and to give a false idea of where the market really is. And of course, it then creates a lot of clutter, because with all of the artists that are out there, it's so difficult to break through. And of course, everybody has their music on these streaming platforms today, and it's to pick and choose them is still very difficult. And I think that's where traditional media and radio and so on still play a very big role, in terms of getting the artists still out there, and it's still a large place for them to get known in that way. And so a lot of the promotion still revolves around that. But my feeling is that, you've got to think of streaming more as a tool in your publicity box than a way to actually make a living these days. And also, this is where the legislation does need to change, because, if there's nothing regulating the market, you'll probably see AI artists starting to take over, and that's a whole nother conversation.
Well, if I can't make money from selling my music, how are musicians making their money?
So what Jonathan is saying is very true. Remember back in the day, if you want to buy a song, you had no choice but to buy a whole CD, which had 9 other songs that you didn't like. Technology has now presented a new challenge in that if I want a specific song, I can buy that specific song without having to buy a CD with tracks I don't need. But that presents a challenge as well, because a stream is equivalent to 0.01 cent. So that means you need so many streams for you to make comfortable money. But look, there's also evolution in the sense that you now make money through other mediums as well. So if you look at what Jonathan was saying, when your music is played on radio, there's other streams of income that comes in from Samro, your Sampra, Capasso, which caters for the digital usage of music. So that's another channel. There's also Syncs, which can also give you a stream of income, which comes from the same recording that you've done as that one song. There's also live performances. So what is required now for an artist is an artist is required to be more woke to what the business requirements are. So you can't just sit there and wait for your music to sell. You need to run this as a business. So you need to look at all the opportunities that are there to earn income and say, how can I work alongside my record label to be able to commercialize? It's not as simple, but it's possible. There are artists to this day who are eating from their recordings, but you just need to understand that the value chain is wider, but it requires an effort for you to be able to search the asset properly and make money. I cannot say there isn't an income that you can make or you can't live off your music. You can, but there is also an effort that's now required of you to get maximum value from your effort, from your assets.
Very interesting, because I must also then ask about the issue of being able to perform. And I think maybe that's also might be a place where we still see things the way they were back in the day. In fact, in the day of fandom, I think people really love their artists. It's a little bit crazy, but it means that people are really willing to pay all that money to go out and see a show. But that also means that as an artist, you need to be able to put up a production, and that might be upfront costs as well. Is that also how that part would work, Jonathan?
Yeah, so it's an interesting aspect in terms of being able to perform live. You know, it requires or demands a lot of an artist in terms of how they develop themselves as a performer to be the best performer and entertainer that they can be. And that's quite a significant, how should I say, development that the artist has to go through in order to be able to sustain themselves with various gigs and being able to perform live constantly. And, you know, at this point, I might make a distinction between, say, for example, artists or performers that are gig performers and then artists that are brand or principal performers. Mm. So, you know, you might go out and watch your favorite artist, and that's one particular stream of revenue that one could pursue. But more likely, if you're going to be a professional musician, you're going to be doing more gigs and doing more corporate shows and, you know, festivals and you know, markets and so on. And so your amount of clientele that you might develop doing that, it's, you know, you'd often play covers as opposed to playing original music, and it's a very different dynamic to be able to perform live like that. And then, of course, you know, going wider than that, there was an interesting look a few months ago at artists touring up Africa, for example, whereas a lot of international artists will come and stop in South Africa, but then very rarely actually tour up the continent. And so this idea of a world tour for a lot of these big artists is actually a myth, because a lot of them don't really go up Africa. And the question was, is how do you then develop that kind of touring circuit to go beyond just South Africa and move up the continent? Because if we can develop that sort of space that musicians can develop themselves playing live, we would see far more growth in terms of live musicians and not just, say, electronic forms of music. So there's a very big dynamic in about how live music can be developed, and I still think there's a long way to go to broaden that area a lot.
Dr. Cook, you mentioned the issue here of contracting. And of course, like you would have mentioned that maybe back in the day, artists were just very happy to be able to record and sell. Today, the issue of contracting must be really, you know, front of mind. And I think there's just more access to legal advice and help, you know, in today's environment. But I'm certain that there are some key things that, you know, artists should really be looking out for in any contract where they would have been a provider of music, and I'm just keen to get your thoughts on what some of that might be.
So you know, the basic entry into this space is that he who pays owns, which is how most artists ended up with music that they did not own, or that were those works were owned by the record labels. So what we do now is the music arena. We've looked at that social ill and said, can we look at the issue of an empowered artist? So most of the deals that we sign are called JV. So you bring we enter into JV with an artist where we now say you own a portion of your works in as much as we are going to pay a chunk of the recordings. That way we get into a business deal as compared to just signing someone, what we used to call signing someone. But when you sign someone, literally they come in as they are. So they become a little project. We hope to make music, but we'll spend money and make a hit. And if we make a hit, we own the hit. They can leverage off the sales and leverage off maybe performances, stage performances. So now, the artists we're dealing with today is a little different in that these kids Google search things. They want to know. They ask questions. I'm lucky to have worked with the older generation and the newer generation, so I can see the approach they are working. That these ones come in as a business person. They have a laptop, they have a computer, but they now go into and search and get answers when they're not sure. Even an agreement, I've seen one who came into my office one, and he took an agreement and did a translation on the site to understand the minimum of 7 technical words that could have been used. So they are more curious than an older recording artist who all they wanted was just to record. So when they're given an agreement, they don't ask questions, they're just fine. So it is a shift in how this specific business is being handled from the generation at present.
Back in the day also, and I think maybe today this could still be a term that we used to hear. We used to hear of people who have gone independent. And people who have gone independent, it meant that, you know, I think if you when you won, you really won. But if you lost, you really lost. I'm wondering if that's still the case, you know, and what that means from an intellectual property perspective in Nkateko.
Absolutely. I mean, there are big labels that we most will sign to. So we, as one of our divisions, Gallo Record Company, so that would fall under a big indie. But then there are individual smaller companies that are called indies where people do their own everything. Then they come to a big license, so they come to a big record to then license their works. That is still the case. But you'd find that when you run an indie, you need a lot of resources. It's very expensive. So most artists, it was easier to run to a big label sign, but also that came with its own complications in that at most they didn't own the works that they were recording, but they were recording artists that were making hits, but they didn't own the hits. And also there's a publishing aspect, which again, even if you run an indie, you still want somebody to publish your works. So the smaller publishers don't necessarily understand certain things, so they go to the big publishers of their music. In that sense, there's still a portion of the money that they earn which has to go to the publisher because they're signed to that publisher. So you can go indie. There's an option available, but there's a lot of resources, a lot of guidance that you need in running a successful indie. The issue with this is that we've seen indies start make hits and then they disappear, which shows you that as soon as they are running, it could be a lack of running sustainable business or understanding how a sustainable business could run, or it could just be when money comes, if the satisfaction is there, they simply just neglect the business. So there's also things that you, conclusions that you draw from how indies make one or two hits and then disappear and then another new one comes in. But yes, there is an option to run an indie. They are lucrative businesses in the music industry. They remove a big chunk of the stress that you get with a big label, but it comes with a responsibility and an effort that you're required to run it like a successful business.
Very interesting. And Jonathan, you also mentioned there, I guess, the fact that, legislation wasn't quite keeping up, and we've touched on it, but I also want to talk about, just the basic legislations that any music, whether you're, gigging and performing covers, or even, producing brand new music here, all of it does come with certain pieces of legislation. I'm curious to touch on those and some of the things that just a musician who could even be listening, or somebody whose child could be thinking of becoming a musician and might be very anxious about it, the kind of things that just need to be understood at a basic level.
You must treat it like a career. So the problem is that you'd find that as parents, when your child comes and says, I want to be a musician, we start saying, no, that's not a career, it's a hobby. But if we were to change the culture that you can build a solid career in music and also teach and also encourage our children to go and study the business of music. It should not be a by the way. You need an education to be able to answer certain things. You can't wing it. That's the basic that I would advise younger people. Once you've got an education, it opens your mind to so many things. You ask the right questions and you enter into the right deals. Whether you're the musician first life, you still need the education and get the right education. And once you've got the basics of education, I think everything else falls into picture because music is talent. So if you've got the talent, you've got the education, you're likely to succeed. In fact, a few in the country that I've interacted with and got to understand how they are succeeding, so they've got an education in the background. But those who try and wing it, it shows that you're trying to win it based on tight and wrongly.
Well, Jonathan, I think that speaks wonderfully to what, of course, you do also there, because, of course, you are in there teaching. I want to speak about that teaching experience and how you sharpen that talent. An important, you know, some of the things Nkateko said there, that there's a difference between somebody who's kind of winging it and somebody who's been technically trained in one aspect or another. I'm keen just to get insights on some of those classroom dynamics that are preparing our musicians.
Perfect. So, you know, my experience is exactly that. I had always run and become a music producer very, very early in my career. And, you know, through experiences I had through dealing with different artists and different role players in the industry, record companies, music publishers, and so on, and the difference between those two, you know, my biggest advice, and I think also where the industry is heading at the moment, is that you can't consider it that it's something fun to do, because I think that's what a lot of people get into music for, is that they see the glamour and you know, being able to make music, and they're going to be happy. From my experience, it's pretty much as stressful as any normal job, I'm afraid. And the idea is that through the education that we're trying to provide students is to prepare them for a world where they can act as professionals making music, and they're well aware of all the different risks that are involved, and that they're able to interact with people in the industry far more effectively. That's essentially where the education is going. And we were talking about indies earlier, for example, and the idea is that you know no one's coming to save you. This is what I always say to different students and so on. No one's coming just to make it happen. It does happen, you know, but it's like winning the lottery, right? And it can be very difficult, and people will take advantage when you've got something. And so the idea is to set people up with the knowledge of, you know, basics about how the business is run. And copyright is a big component of that, and contracts, and understanding what you're signing away. And also, you know, there's so many situations where people will make music together, yet the last thing they think about is their shares in that music. And the moment that they want to now make money, or there's a ton of money that suddenly gets made because the song has become famous, you know, I'm thinking of Jerusalem and all of those situations that happen, and now suddenly there's money on the table, and we suddenly have to agree to something, people will change their minds about what they do very quickly, because everyone will play a bigger role in somehow making that music. So we try and unpack you know, the study of it, you know, you could sort of call it the study of music business sciences, is to try and figure out what is the equilibrium, what is the most fair situation. Not that you will encounter that very much, but at least you have some sense of what you're looking for in that business relationship. Stop thinking of record companies as, you know, your absolute fame engine, and rather start thinking of them as business partners, and so on and so forth. And this is the type of thinking and shift that we're trying to instill. And again, it comes with how the industry has changed over the years, and how musicians can become far more independent very quickly, but still rely a lot on the different role players that are in the industry.
Well, gentlemen, it's all we have time for this evening. I do hope that we've plugged a few people, given, you know, prospective parents and musicians, some form of perspective around this issue. I'd like to thank you both so much for your time this evening. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you so much.
Wonderful. That was Nkateko Maluleke, General Manager of the Music Arena, and Jonathan Shaw, Music Producer, Business Consultant, and Music Technology and Business Lecturer at M&D Multimedia Institute.
You've been listening to a Power 98.7 podcast. For more podcasts, visit power987.co.za or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.